Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. We've probably all heard that Old Chestnut Boston is the Athens of America, a hub of cultural influence, democratic values, and staid intellectualism. Yale historian Mark Peterson, who's here with us, takes that comparison even farther. He argues that Boston, over hundreds of years, starting in the mid-17th century, carved itself into what he calls a New England city-state empire. That's before it was fully absorbed into the new, then new, larger nation with the ratification of the Constitution. And he says that ratification was detrimental to Boston and to Massachusetts going into then the 18th and 19th centuries. So a bit of a history lesson at this moment. His book spans three centuries, which he acknowledges is an unusually deep time span for a book on one American city. But it is called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power. Mark Peterson, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Boy, it's a heavy book, too. It's got a good paper stock. It's a really big book, but we are going to take a sliver. A little background. You begin with the Puritans. You take us through the Civil War, and throughout you refer to Boston as a city-state. What does that mean exactly in your definition of history?
Well, in effect, I'm describing the origins of Boston as something like the last Renaissance city-state, in that its founders imagined that they were doing something quite like what lay at the origins of a place like Venice, for instance. That is, part of their commitment, of course, was religious, and they looked to the Bible, to the apostles, and conceived that they were bringing apostolic Christianity to a new continent in much the way that, say, the Apostle Paul had done in the first century. And they even went so far as to make the Great Seal of the Massachusetts Bay Company be, in effect, a quotation from St. Paul in the dream that he has that a man from Macedon asks him to come over and bring Christianity there. And so the Great Seal of Massachusetts has the image of a Native American and Indians quoting Paul's dream, saying, come over and help us.
Mm-hmm. And we're not going to get to this today, but there's an issue with the symbol on the Massachusetts flag, which is also from the 17th century, questioning that symbol now in the 21st century.
Right.
Would you though paint a picture of Boston in the 1600s as an autonomous city-state where Native Americans are living, where the colonists show up? What's it look like?
Well, at the beginning, Boston, the founders of Boston are doing something that no other English colony had really managed up to that time. That is bringing really large numbers of colonists over, something like 20,000 in the first 10 years, and settling on a tract of territory that was granted in their charter that was quite small compared to the other colonial projects in early America. And so starting from Massachusetts Bay and planting themselves on the Shawmut Peninsula that becomes Boston, they begin essentially fanning out, finding farmland, finding places to settle. And so the first part of the book describes this process and how essentially Boston hives off not only Massachusetts but other new colonies like Connecticut and New Hampshire, and Maine becomes part of Massachusetts.
Are we calling it New England yet?
Yes, they are, but they were actually calling it New England before then. That is, the English crown, the early colonists, tended to call the whole region north of Virginia New England. And so what Boston is doing is essentially claiming a part of it and expanding that claim through the course of the 17th century.
And then what was happening in the other colonies at the time? Was it unparalleled at all?
Well, most of them were struggling quite badly. One of the things that makes Massachusetts succeed early on, that is, to a much greater degree, is that many of those 20,000 colonists were selling off their assets in England, their farms, their shops, etc., bringing their money with them and using it to invest in the colony. And so Massachusetts was much better supported than, say, Virginia was in its early days. And they turned that investment towards a very idealistic vision of the kind of colony they want. Mm-hmm. So that includes, famously, the Puritan churches that every town was required to produce, but also a very intensive form of self-government, of republican government, that also was quite antithetical to English tradition at the time.
And healthy in this area. I realize this is a story of colonists. This is not a mm-hmm. story about coming to this land where Native Americans were living in various tribes that we know of today and who are still here today. So we're not going to get too much into that. We do want to hear, again, about this sort of notion that Massachusetts and Boston in particular was above and beyond anything else going on and could have stayed that way had it not been for the Constitution. We're going to jump really fast ahead, a couple of centuries to the American Revolution of 1776. And before that time, we learned that, Boston has managed to defeat the crown. They overthrew the governor of the Dominion of New England. The city has persisted. Today you have the Freedom Trail, right, and Patriots Day, and all these things are marking what it managed to do as a city. And then the U.S. Constitution becomes ratified, and you say that you are unique in saying this as an historian, that it wasn't such a good thing for Boston, that maybe it took away what Boston could have been.
Well, yes, and let me make clear from the beginning that I don't mean that many of the things that are in the U.S. Constitution that, are revered today or that have been beneficial are things that Boston and Massachusetts were opposed to. The Bill of Rights, for instance, was in many ways the product of the efforts of Massachusetts in the ratification process. The Massachusetts Constitution had a Bill of Rights, and the lack of that in the original draft of the National Constitution is something that Massachusetts voters in their constitutional convention insisted ought to be in the Constitution. So I don't mean it in that sense. What I mean is that while it was officially a colony of Britain, Boston had created this city-state and had managed to remain or to retain a great deal of autonomy, of self-government under that. And its economy had linked it to other parts of the British Empire, most importantly to the economy of the West Indies, where huge numbers of enslaved people were being forced to produce sugar. And so that was economically viable for Massachusetts, but the advantage under the British Empire was the planters of the West Indies had no political control over or authority over Boston and Massachusetts. And what changed with the U.S. Constitution was that from that point forward, the United States or Massachusetts was voluntarily making itself part of a United States Congress where a slave-owning dominant majority would have direct power over Massachusetts.
Right, and that being Virginia,
Carolina, all of the southern slaveholding states whose power was augmented by the Three-Fifths Clause to be able to pass laws that in the very short run actually were quite detrimental to Boston and New England's interests.
So let's keep giving listeners a timeline. So we Massachusetts likes to remember that itself as the center of the abolition movement, but that was the 19th century. But before that, there was a slave trade, as you just described, and much of the region's economy depended on it. But let's dig into this idea that with the Constitution, Massachusetts ceded that control and power to the southern states, to those slaveholders. Could there have been another way? Rewrite history, right?
But there already was another way, mm-hmm. which we call the Articles of Confederation, right? Which was a pact among equal states. And that pact had, for instance, no taxing power over individuals. And it required supermajorities for the national government to take powerful action. And under that system, it would have been impossible for the national government to do things like embargo the entirety of the United States trade, which the Jefferson administration does in 1807, and which is horribly destructive to Massachusetts for 2 years, where the city cannot legally trade outside of Boston Harbor.
So, you write this book now. It may be just that you've been working on it for a decade or 5 years, or maybe your entire, 20 years. And you say much of this, much of the information you base your research on and your writing has been available in archives. You have pulled together a different narrative, not of what happened, but what could have been by looking at the strength of this city-state through these three centuries. Why now, if there is an answer to that? Why, besides that it took 20 years to write, why is it important to know this story?
Well, it's an excellent question. It isn't a counterfactual history. Everything in it that happened did happen, right? But one of the problems that I was trying to deal with all along is the way in which the modern history of the United States casts a shadow backwards over the colonial history. And so it tends to sort events from the past into favoring those that led obviously towards the United States and obscure those that don't move in that direction. And what I was trying to do was to highlight how contingent, how uncertain the evolution of the United States was, and actually focus on an alternative kind of polity, because actually for the past 20 years or so, I've been fairly convinced that the United States is in serious trouble, that its constitution is broken, that the role of the nation state internally and in the world is suffering from some serious problems. And so I thought it was a good idea to give a consideration anyway to the long history of a place that operated in different terms, that governed itself on a much more local basis.
Right. And we won't have time today to talk about whether Philadelphia or New York City could have, you know, in its early days through those three centuries done anything. You're saying no. But I do want to ask you quickly, because we have about a minute, that, you know, you just mentioned this. What lessons can we learn from history as you look forward as an historian and a scholar at where we are today? What did the Bostonians back then give us? What might you tap into or spread the word on?
The first thing I would say is that when things needed changing, they changed them. When things were worth preserving, they preserved them, right? And so I do think that the United States is in a bind today constitutionally and politically, and it's incumbent on us to figure out how to change them, not to mindlessly or blindly simply preserve the past.
Well, Mark Peterson, thank you for writing this. It is very readable, by the way. It's just large, like 800 pages plus index, right? It's a wonderful look back. It's complicated, too, and maybe controversial. Thank you for coming in. Mark Peterson is a professor of history at Yale University. The book is called The City-State of Boston, The Rise and Fall of an Atlantic Power, 1630 to 1865. Thanks again.
Many thanks.
Mark Peterson will be speaking tonight at the Massachusetts Historical Society. He'll be at the Harvard Coop April 25th. You can find out more from our website, radioboston.org. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Renee Marchaudeau. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us again tomorrow for Radio Boston.